I just texted you my setup there.
Oh, okay. Now you're just bragging. It's interesting. You're coming through loud and clear because of that microphone. And
yeah.
I probably sound like I am from...
You, I don't know. To me, you sound like you're kind of like in a tin canny.
Western Montana? Like,
no, just kind of like on a phone or something.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what I am. So that works out.
Okay.
So
I don't hear any alerts. And then you have this down here. If you need to...
Yep, I see it.
If we say something.
Like if I need to say wrap it up.
Right.
You've been going on for 7 minutes about Skyline Chili. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by, well, everybody recognizes his voice by now. It's C. Trent Rosecrans of The Athletic, the Cincinnati Reds, and all everything baseball writer for The Athletic there, based in Cincinnati. And today, Trent, we would be sitting nearby each other at Great American Ballpark for the traditional festivities of opening day, which is it fair to call it a civic holiday there? Is that how you would call
it? I think it officially is.
What, really?
I'm somewhat percent sure. I'm more than 50% sure. Maybe 50% sure.
Because there's a parade. I mean, walk us through all the celebration
that would
be going on at this time.
I've never been to the parade because I'm always working.
Okay. But you know of its existence.
Yeah. There is a parade. You know, the night before it kind of starts. Last night I was supposed to have a live show at the Banks, which is kind of like what's the thing beyond right field, the Ballpark Village? It's kind of like the Ballpark Village, but in Cincinnati, except it's not owned by the Reds. So they don't get the income from it. So it's not quite as themed. But yeah, it's kind of like that.
Yeah. It doesn't have Reds branding.
Right. But like we were going to have Paul Danner Jr., who is kind of our local columnist for The Athletic for Cincinnati, and I were going to be doing a live show. This was going to be a little bit after the Reds do their show. We were kind of going to be the... I guess the letterman to their Carson. And so we're going to do that.
That's a pre-podcast dated reference. How many
people? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could go, what would be the updated one?
Conan to their Leno.
Yeah. I mean, Conan to their Leno, that's still kind of dated. I mean, podcasts weren't really a thing when that happened.
So the Seth Meyers to their,
I guess.
What do we got? No? Okay.
I don't know. I guess Seth Meyers Jimmy is okay.
Fallon? The Meyers to their Jimmy Fallon?
Yeah. I mean, I'd rather be Meyers than Fallon. That's for sure.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah, I'll take that.
I always thought of you as the Seth Meyers of baseball writers.
Really? Mm-hmm. Huh.
Pushing the envelope, quirky. Doing what everybody else should be doing before they do it. Yep.
Is Seth Meyers that? Is that how you consider Seth Meyers? Okay. I always think like that description, and I'm not saying I am a Conan O'Brien, but that description to me is Conan O'Brien.
I just didn't want to go with the dated reference. I would have done Conan O'Brien.
And then Letterman before that. I mean, both those guys. I mean, that slot. Right.
This is what everybody came for. Conan O'Brien of baseball writers then. Right down to the string dance that you do before first pitch, which is a little creepy, but it's
okay. You know, it's for the ladies.
So back to the parade. So you would have done a live podcast on the eve of celebration.
Yeah, and that's something we had done before. Haven't you been a guest for that?
I have. Yeah, it was great. It was 10 years ago, and it was a lot of
fun. Was that 10 years ago?
It was a little while back, yeah.
Wow. So yeah, so then in the morning, Findlay Market Parade. Findlay Market, okay. This would have been the 101st opening day parade. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is not like a new thing.
No. I know it's the historic first opener. It used to be written in that the Reds would throw the first pitch of the regular season as a tribute to their status as the first professional sports team.
Yeah, even though that is now technically it's the Braves, right? I mean, that's that franchise.
Right.
So yeah, but yeah, so there's that. It's just a big deal. The joke is kind of always that that's when they know they'll get the one sellout, and then after that it goes back to normal and not as many people. But they've actually done a kind of a cool thing a couple years ago to try to extend it. I mean, this is all crass marketing, but it's also good marketing. They have opening night, so they do a lot of the same. Like the second game is always is usually a night game, and they do you know, a big thing there where they do like a red carpet and they do the full intros and all that kind of thing. And they call that opening night. So it's the first night game. Also first done in Cincinnati, the first night game in Major League Baseball. Kansas City Monarchs, of course, had done plenty before that. So let's give credit to where credit's due. So many of these things started in the Negro Leagues and that, that great history, but that's a sidestep anyway. And then, so they'd also do like usually that Sunday, cause it's usually like a weekend. It's usually like a Thursday off day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or somewhere around Wednesday off day, whatever. And a 4-game series on like, I think either that Saturday or Sunday, the next day game, they do like a kids opening day. So they have a lot of stuff for kids. So, I mean, they try to, that's crass marketing, but it's also kind of cool and it works because, you know, getting those opening day tickets can be tough. Everybody wants to go. It's the same as in St. Louis, except, you know, the Cardinals know that they're going to get their crowd regardless. So they almost always open on the road, don't they?
They do. Yeah, it's by design. People don't like to hear it here and they always wonder about it, but the Cardinals do not prioritize opening at home. Partially for the reason that you just mentioned, because they know that whenever they open, it's going to be a huge festival with Clydesdales and the Hall of Famers in their red coats and the Sea of Red and all the planning and all the events that happen downtown. And they know it's going to be a sellout and they know it's going to be a celebration. Well, it's
right.
Not,
it's the same reason they made that park mediocre. It's they just didn't have to.
Well,
because the baseball is the draw, as it should be.
Right, right. Well, baseball and kind of the community history of baseball. I mean, they benefit from a huge tailwind of history that other older teams do not. I mean, it's become like a generational tradition, right? And part of it is just absolute luck, let's be honest, right? Every generation of Cardinal fans has a championship.
Going that's back a really good point.
Plus years. That's luck on the generation's standpoint. Every generation has a Hall of Famer. Again,
that's wow, just
luck on. I mean, you know. So,
have you done a big thing on this? Because I love this. I'd never thought of it this way.
Yeah. I did a big. I've done a couple big stories on that. You know, just
that's really cool.
And I one time I did a timeline of how they haven't, you know, they haven't been without a Hall of Famer until. And really, you know, the only question now is, does Yadier Molina become a Hall of Famer to extend it? Because they have always had a Hall of Famer from Rogers Hornsby continuously through Tony La Russa retiring in 2011 and Albert Pujols becoming a free agent. They have had a continuing line of Hall of Famers either connected as a coach or player for the team. It's remarkable.
That is really cool.
I mean, like for you and I, we grew up as baseball fans in the 80s, right?
Uh-huh.
So our
you're a Yankees fan, right?
Yeah. Yep. Our youth is the 80s and 90s, pretty much. And that's what we remember. Well, if you're an 80s and 90s kid in St. Louis, like my colleague Benjamin Hockman was, well, you adored the 80s teams. You were rewarded with championships, and that was your life's blood during the dismal times of the 90s when, oh, by the way, Mark McGwire showed up towards the end of it to then, you know, create havoc on the home run record. And your dad had the 60s, and your granddad had Musial, and his granddad had Hornsby and Pete Alexander. And so you have these stories that just happened to collect with generations. And, you know, my son has the 11 team with David Freese, the hometown boy.
Mm-hmm.
you know, so now that continues. It's just a fluke of timing where every 20 years, this generation has a harbor to park their fandom and forever get fuel from it.
Right. And like, I hear that so often in Cincinnati, because you think about it, they had so many of those, but they have great like swaths of time where they weren't relevant.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And so like there's, if you were, you know, I talked to 30-year-olds who were like, they've never won in my lifetime.
Yeah. No. You don't have
and really they haven't advanced in the playoffs since 1995.
Yeah.
So that's 25 years.
That's enough for somebody to have been born and be a doctor, right?
Yeah. Well, no, it's most definitely, because I was just thinking about this the other day, is that like when my mom was my age, she had a kid that was a doctor, which makes me feel terribly old.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, my sister was a doctor in 94 or 95. So she was 25. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is when she graduated from medical school.
Don't have that. I mean, there are Cardinal fans that now will have gone to kindergarten and are ready to graduate from high school next year, I guess, and have only known one losing season.
Wow. And, you know, the Reds went from like 2000 to 2000. I mean, the aughts of the 2000s, they didn't have a winning season.
Yeah. So this is part of why the Cardinals, and that kind of loops us back, this is why the Cardinals don't want to open at home, is because they know their fans will show, and they want to limit April home dates because they know how hard they are to sell. It's a business decision, and they don't really hide from it. They need the sustenance of ticket sales, and they're going to do everything they can to sell tickets. They're going to do value-added tickets. They're going to give away bobbleheads and championship ring replicas and all this stuff. And you can look at their promotions calendar and know, oh, well, they think that's going to be a hard ticket to sell. And they know, just like every team does, that April is a hard time to sell. You know, kids usually, obviously, this is a different year. It's a profoundly different year. But in regular years, baseball in April coincides with school in April. And, you know, night games in April don't always sell because kids have to get to school the next day and so on and so on. And so the Cardinals say, you know what, we'll open on the road. We're cool with starting out, you know, 6 games, 9 games on the road and kick that April opener back some, because that will limit the number of April dates at Busch Stadium.
So here's a nice trivia question. Do you know the last time the Reds did not open at home?
I do not.
And this could be this year too, you know,
right.
Because yeah. I think what we're looking at is maybe like a resumption of the season when and if it starts. But it was a similar thing. It was the 1990
workout. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, they're going to start where the schedule says they can pick up, because all the arenas and stadiums and hotels and everything are all set. It's just streamlined.
If they
can pull that off. But
yes. If they can pull that off. But yeah, it was 1990, the lockout. And that's one of those funny things. You know, another season that was 1995. The Reds did open at home, but that was also another delayed season because of the strike. And the Reds won the Central and lost to the Braves in the playoffs. And then another one that I had looked up, another season that was delayed in part because of war, in part because of the Spanish flu, was 1919.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The season ended early in 1918. And then
That's right. Started late in 1919.
Yeah.
Reds won then too.
Interesting. Well, I want to build off of that, but first I have to tell people about our sponsor. Imagine your home totally organized. Closet by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. That's Closet by Design, official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. You can reach Closet by Design at 314-733-9855 in the St. Louis area. That's Closet by Design, 314-733-9855. Though I guess you can reach them in any area. That's Closet by Design, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. You just ran through the trivia questions of how are the answers to, you know, shortened seasons and what that has meant for the Reds. Tell me about the level of excitement you sense for this 2020 Reds team. You know, they had one of the more active off seasons. They had a strong finish. They definitely got the attention of their rivals.
They had a strong, not a strong finish. You know, September was pretty bad because they, from July or like May-ish to September. I mean, they did play pretty well. And a lot of that started with the pitching because when you look at that rotation, at the end of the year, Trevor Bauer was your weak link. And that's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. He's a really good fourth starter if he's your fourth starter.
Yeah, and he's probably their third starter. But, I mean, Luis Castillo, that's pretty good. Sonny Gray got a Cy Young votes last year. And then you have Trevor Bauer. I think Anthony DeSclafani is a guy that, I don't know, he seems to me kind of like a Cardinals pitcher.
Huh, and,
you know, just one of those guys that you're like, he doesn't seem to have all that great of stuff, but he just, I mean, maybe even in the Dave Duncan era, you know, like a Dave Duncan era. And I'm not saying like his repertoire or whatever, just like that guy. He's like, you know what? Every time he goes out, he's better than I thought he was. Yeah. And I kind of think of that.
The Cardinals fits.
Does he? Yeah, I guess he does. I didn't have it looked at, but he kind of reminds me of that. And then your fifth starter is Wade Miley.
Pretty good.
That's or this year. But last year, what I was saying was September, they really, the flu went through the clubhouse and they were playing shorthanded, for a lot of that month. They had injuries like Nick Senzel, Jesse Winker, and those guys went down. And then they had a flu. Like there were days where they were playing with 20 guys, even in September with expanded rosters. They called up Christian Colon, who had finished his AAA season, was at home in Arkansas. He was having like a board game night with friends when this phone rang and said, "Hey, can you come to Cincinnati? We just need bodies."
Interesting.
And so
did he say, "Well, let me check my calendar"?
He did not. Okay. We were talking about growing up in the times what we did. I was born in 1975. I'm quite a bit younger than you. And
that's amazing.
My parents are from Missouri, as we've talked about on here. I even say Missouri. Middle of the state. And I grew up a Royals fan. So, you know, you talk about that generation. So they went 30 years between those championships. That would be 30 years if the Reds won this year. And so anytime I mention Christian Colon, I need to call him World Series hero Christian Colon.
Oh, I like it. That's good. Yeah.
So they called up World Series hero Christian Colon, just for a body, just because they were so decimated. And then like, Freddie Galvis was playing on one leg and, you just had guys, he was playing hurt all of September. So, you know, that September, they weren't that great. But, like, I think you saw the makings of a pretty decent team.
Yeah.
And to that pretty decent team, they added Nick Castellanos. I'm sure the Cardinals saw a bit of Nick Castellanos last year.
They saw him raking doubles off the Ivy Wall, yep.
Yeah. And then you put Nick Castellanos in this ballpark, which – I'm not sure how that helps or hurts because, you know, this is a ballpark, Great American Ballpark, that rewards home runs and gives some home runs, but it takes away it suppresses every other type of base hit other than the home run.
Some of his doubles are going to be singles.
Yeah.
I agree. That's an interesting.
And when you look at those, you know, you look at those charts of like where things land, And you look at it and you put it up against Great American Ballpark, it looks like, whoa. But you also have to remember that those dots, that's not where it lands on the fly. That's where the ball stops, where somebody picks it up.
Oh, yeah, good point. Good point.
And so a lot of those are line drives that go into the gaps. And when the gaps aren't as big like they aren't at Great American Ballpark, it suppresses, it turns doubles into singles.
Yeah, I thought
it turns that, some doubles and singles into outs.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was really interesting as the Reds kind of, you know, worked their way through the outfield options, and they made a play for Marcell Ozuna and obviously eventually signed Castellanos. I thought that was an interesting kind of way to compare them. I thought that Marcell Ozuna in that ballpark, given how hard he hits the ball and really how curiously few doubles he's hit here recently, that he would be a monster in that ballpark.
They did too.
He might be even
preferred him.
Yeah, that's what I wondered. They preferred him. Okay, interesting.
As far as I can tell, they preferred him. Nobody has told me that on the record, but
they seem to offer more money. Younger. Yeah. So that's part of it. But yeah, I thought him in that ballpark would be a monster. And, you know, in talking to, you know, your president of baseball operations and GM there at the GM meetings, I was really struck by, you know, I spoke to them about, you know, the pitching improvement. And then, of course, they made upgrades to their pitch coaching and their pitch analytics and their pitch process. And I want to ask you about that as well. But the points that they made to me was, look, they think they can take hitters and create offense because of the ballpark they have. And one of the ways that they really saw improvement last year was their ability to suppress the offense of other teams with their pitching and how that could be an element of their success. They don't, you know, they recognize they're going to have to win some games 14-10 because of the ballpark, maybe some football games, but that if they can overall suppress runs there, then the ballpark will help them create the offense that maybe they don't need to. Sort similar like how the Rockies honestly should be built. They should look for the offensive struggling gifted defensive players and go after them and see what the ballpark makes of their offense.
I've been saying for years they should have Billy Hamilton.
I'm shocked that they haven't made a play for Harrison Bader.
Oh yeah, he'd be amazing there.
He would be amazing as a in Coors Field, and he'd be like, and his hit tool or his offense would take a spike, would benefit from that ballpark.
Yeah, is he a big strikeout guy?
Yeah, he is. He is. Yeah.
I mean, the balls he does put in play. It's the same. It's honestly, it's the same argument I always made about Billy Hamilton with Harrison Bader. The exact same argument.
Similar. Yeah. It's very similar.
A lot of his balls put in play would turn into hits because of the size of that park, and then so many hits he could take away because he is so, so gifted defensively.
Not only that, but I know Billy Hamilton and watched him far more than I did, but in watching Harrison Bader, there are singles that he'll have that he would have at Coors Field that would be doubles.
Oh, I saw that in the small sample size.
Yeah.
I saw the small sample size with Billy Hamilton. I mean, you're talking like, and with Billy in Coors Field, and I'm sure Harrison Bader, the exact same thing, having watched Bader the little bit that I have, you know, you're talking not only singles that are doubles, but doubles that are triples and unforced errors. Because
absolutely,
when both those guys hit the ball, fielders react differently. They can cause unforced errors. They force errors.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. It has been requested that I no longer go on my Rockies GM rant on this podcast, so I won't do that. But
well, you're not qualified.
Right. For those who have listened to the best podcast in baseball and have enjoyed my rants about it, just imagine one here. And then out of respect for the person who stopped my rants about how I'm not a brain surgeon, so how could I possibly know anything about baseball? Then, I'm not gonna do it. I'm gonna fight the urge. So there was excitement. So the Reds fans. More so than how long?
2011.
Okay.
That was when they came off. It didn't. And then I think there was some in 2013 as well. 'Cause 2012, they were, 2012, they were arguably the best team in baseball.
Yes. Yes. That's a great point. Yes.
They
were really, they were a well-balanced
Oh, man. Yeah,
they were a fearsome team. That's right.
I mean, there are a lot of what-ifs in that 2012. Paul Daner Jr., who I mentioned earlier, is doing a story about that I think should run next week or so. It was already scheduled, the what-ifs of 2012. Like, what if Johnny Cueto doesn't get hurt in the first inning of the NLDS? Because he gets hurt in the first inning. And this is a team that used five starters for 161 games that year.
Yeah, yeah. That was the last team to do it. And that's the recipe for 100 wins, and they didn't get it. But yes.
And the one game that wasn't started that way was a makeup doubleheader that they had to bring somebody up.
Nice.
And so, I mean, like, basically all five of their starting pitchers made every scheduled start.
Wow.
And then in the first inning of the first playoff game, Johnny Cueto gets hurt.
Jeez.
Right there against the Giants. Yep. Right there against the Giants in San Francisco. And then they go on to win that game. Sam LaCure comes in, Missouri guy, from Centerville. My aunt's former next door neighbor. And because it's a small world, so he comes in, and then Matt Latos comes in and pitches really well. Mm-hmm. And then the next day in San Francisco, because this was the first year of that,
right? I was just going to bring that up because it was a 2-3, which it was helped a 2-3 as well.
But it should have helped the Reds because they won games 1 and 2. Bronson Arroyo pitches this just whale of a game 2. So they go back to Cincinnati up 2-0 against the Giants. Oh man, I miss covering that guy. Like just one of the all time easiest guys to cover and best to cover ever. He still lives here in Cincinnati.
Really good for him.
Here's a side story because you know we've got nothing if not time. He came in a couple times last year, and you know what he'll do? He helps out the clubbies. He cleans spikes because the clubbies he invited or like, I think, no, he didn't invite because he didn't get married. He's not getting married. That's kind of a Bronson thing. But Bronson, he's like, I think one of the clubbies got married and he showed up and went to their wedding. He was in town. This was, I think, right before his comeback. He came into town. This was when he was not living here. And was at the wedding. I think he took all the clubbies on a vacation once. He just really understood. He really liked the clubbies and appreciated what they did for him and for the team.
That's awesome.
And so a couple times last year, you'd be sitting there after a game. You know what it's like after a game, and you're doing your interviews, and you hear the people pounding this and cleaning the spikes. You can hear that. It's not like that at St. Louis. In Cincinnati, we still have that. It's in the clubhouse. You'll hear them cleaning the spikes.
We don't know what it'll be like.
Right. Okay. What it was like.
Yeah.
So you know that sound well.
Yep.
And it's a big part of just our everyday life.
It's a soundtrack to postgame.
It is.
It does help measure the – I don't know if you can do this, and maybe I just have talked myself into the ability to do this, but I know the time without looking at my clock. So like after a game, like I know, okay, game ended at this. I can tell you, somebody could ask me after we've been in the clubhouse for a little while, what time is it? And I will tell them the clock time, and I won't have looked at a clock. I won't know it, but I just know like the pace or the pace
I think I could have done that part of it. I could have done that a couple years ago. Because now I don't have the deadline.
I have the two deadlines and one of them comes really fast. And so it's I know where I need to be. I can tell you what time it is. I tell you how long it takes me to get up to the press, you know, just, and I can do, I don't just do that in St. Louis. I can do that anywhere now.
Same.
So that thump, thump, thump that you're talking about, that to me is part of the percussion of the post game where you just, it's just part of the beat, part of the rhythm.
Yeah.
That you're like, okay, this is where it's happening.
100% most definitely. So anyway, like I was saying, is sometimes there are a couple times last year where you do that, and then like you go and you're walking on your way out, and usually that takes place near where we walk out mm-hmm. of the clubhouse, and it's like, oh, hey, Bronson. Bronson was just there doing it because he wanted to hang out with the clubbies, and so he's there cleaning spikes.
That's great. I really admire the relationships the clubbies in Cincinnati have created with the players. That's always something that's always struck me. It has always struck me.
I think they are considered part of the team.
Yeah, they have a great personality there. They you know, a lot of them have been there for a long time. It's just really nice to see. Well, so back to 12.
It starts with the Stubb family, but yeah.
Yeah. Great point. So 2012, Arroyo, they leave San Francisco.
Yeah.
With needing to win one of three games at home.
Yep.
And
so that first game. They don't. Yeah. But, that first game of it, or game three, is probably, I'm a big believer in this, and I think he would agree too. It's probably the best game that Homer Bailey ever pitched. Wow. This is a guy with two no-hitters. Game three is October 9th, 2012, a 2-1 victory by the Giants over the Reds in 10 innings. Let's see. Oh man, now I'm looking through it. Okay. Let's start here. Homer, let's see. I'm sorry. My computer's been a little slow. Ryan Vogelsong is pitching for the Giants that game. And Homer Bailey goes 7 innings, 1 hit, 1 run, 1 walk, 10 strikeouts.
Wow.
I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So the first inning, Brandon Phillips singled to center field. Then, this is against Vogelsong, and he steals second. But I'm trying to remember. I think the ball got away at some point. Or he went second, and he tried to go first to third on that. And he gets thrown out at third. Makes the first out at third base. You know, one of the cardinal sins of baseball. Zach Cozart, who was...
They call it a red sin.
Hey-o! Zach Cozart then walks. Joey Votto flies out. Then Ludwig single, Cozart goes to second. That would have been 1-0. Bruce single, Cozart scores, Ludwig to second. So that's Cozart scores there too. And then Scott Rowland strikes out. So you would have, it's 2-0 there instead of 1-0.
Right.
And this, I mean, again, all these things could have changed, but this is a game that ends up 2-1. That's the one run the Reds scored in 10 innings. And Homer Bailey, again, lights out. His, top of the third, hit by pitch, walk, bunt, ground out, sacrifice fly, ground out. That's that inning. That's the one run against Homer. Is a hit by pitch and a walk. Not even on a hit.
Wow.
But this is a game. So then you come back, game four. And let's see, game four was Mike Leake pitches, doesn't pitch great. But Barry Zito only goes 2 2/3. Leake, say they lose that game. Well, Leake wasn't scheduled to pitch that game. He was going to be a swing man. But because Cueto is out, instead of Lato's pitching that game on full rest, it's Mike Leake pitching that game, and he gives up 5 runs in 4 1/3. And then the next game is game five, and that's Lato's back. And I remember writing this as a tweet, but it was kind of honestly right on. I'm looking at it right now. The first four innings of that game is why the Reds traded for Matt Latos. The fifth inning is why the Padres traded him. Because he just blew up. He gave up six runs, including the Buster Posey Grand Slam. And if you go back, there's a great gif of that. I mean, as Posey, as soon as he makes contact, you see Ryan Hannigan, the catcher, just his reaction is just disgust. He knew it was gone. He knew Latos missed a spot. And it was, you know, grand slam. Anyway, they come back. That final, that's the only six runs they score in that game. It's a 6-4 final. This includes just this, one of the, maybe the best at bat I've ever seen. With, they just scored, because they scored in the ninth with Sergio Romo. Let's see, foul pop fly by Phillips, walk to Cozart, single by Votto. So you have first and second with Votto. Ludwig singles to left. Cozart scores, Votto to second base.
Former Colonel Ryan Ludwig.
Yeah. So it's 6-4, two on. Two on. Jay Bruce versus Sergio Romo. I believe it's a 12-pitch at-bat, including one that Bruce pulls just foul to right field. And he gets him to fly out to left. I mean, this is a 6-4 game, two on, one out in the ninth.
Yeah.
Scott Rowland strikes out swinging to end the game. Also, oh, I forgot in game three, you had two errors in that game, mm-hmm. In the 10th, including an the winning run scored on an E5 by Scott Rowland. There was also a passed ball right before that allowed that runner to get to third. And that was on Ryan Hannigan, who was a really good defensive. I mean, you had two defensive mistakes on guys that you don't expect to make defensive mistakes in that situation. And that's how the Giants scored the second run and won that game.
Ongoing series of tangents, that this description reminds me of the fact that those San Francisco Giants in 2012 on their way to the World Series took out the Reds, who were a better team, took out the defending World Series champs and the Cardinals in the NLCS,
who were a better team,
and then faced the Cy Young staff of the Detroit Tigers.
Yeah,
a better
pitching staff.
Scherzer, Verlander. Well, I mean,
Miguel Cabrera. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they a pretty good team. All right. So it strikes me that, like, if this is the Reds team that can capture the imagination or at least create enthusiasm the most since that 2012 team fell apart at home in front of the home crowd, which has lingering effects when a team does that, for sure, especially one that teases greatness by going up 2-0 and then comes home and can't put together the best show for the home crowd.
Yeah. But so I would say that this is more exciting than 2013, because you're right. I think that did cast a pall over it, even though that was a team that won 97 games.
Unbelievable.
They were 97-65 that year.
So this year's team, I think, added to it because really they hit off-season Yahtzee, in my opinion. I mean, and you know, they had, they signed a major free agent. They embraced analytics very publicly, so that's two bells there. They have a charismatic manager who adores Cincinnati and is beloved by the fans.
Right? I don't know that he is, but he's appreciated that he's a hometown guy.
Feisty, and he stands up. He is. They got to love him.
It's funny. In the background, I had started watching the July 30th game.
Yeah.
So that's on my TV in my office, the July 30th game against the Pirates.
Yeah.
Just cause it's so funny. I texted, I don't know if people remember that, but that is the game. It's maybe the craziest game I've ever seen. And this is like an 11-4 blowout.
Right. Yeah,
because you had Amir Garrett taking on the entire team and Yasiel Puig getting traded all at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he was in withdrawal while he was being traded. That's crazy.
I said to Jim Day, I texted Jim Day, who was kind of does their Red sideline, but also does some play by play. He was on play by play that night, and I just texted him as I was watching it last night, and he goes, "Oh my, you just called it, quote, a crazy one at Great American Ballpark, unquote, as Amir comes out of the bullpen. You were so young and naive." And then he said, they're like doing the, you know, this game's had this, this, and this. So what else could happen?
So you have the free agent, the analytics, the manager who brings a little spice to it and is a great guy, hometown guy. You add in the fact that you have a polarizing pitcher, a guy who can be loved by the home crowd and hated everywhere else he pitches in Trevor Bauer. Mm-hmm. You have young stud players. I mean, look at the excitement that the young shortstop created in spring training.
He's not part of that. But that is a good point.
Creating this vibe.
Yeah, Jose Garcia. Jose Garcia's Cuban shortstop.
I think there's still tangible benefits to entertaining a fan base with not just the team that's coming home, but the team that is still, or the talent that is still on the horizon. I just think the Reds hit position where they are,
the one question mark. You know, that's the one spot that everybody said, well, what about shortstop?
Right. And there's excitement.
It's a guy. Yeah. No, you're right.
So, it's just interesting. So what would, do you think, we're hopeful that there is still a season. It's hard to wrap your mind around 162 games season. Boris recommends that you can do it, and then you'd have the World Series on Christmas Day,
which fits
neatly into his proposal that he's brought up many times to have a neutral site World Series so that you could create a Super Bowl-type atmosphere. But did you think – all right, so the eve of baseball shutting down, did you think the Reds were the best team in the division, or they had the – oh, and I forgot to add, there's the added part of – the Reds fans can look at chaos in Chicago and,
yes,
you know, oh, yeah, basically, I think this
is a bigger part of it. The bigger part of this is they are the only team on paper that got better in the division.
Yeah.
On paper, they're the only team that got better. They're the only team that you arguably, that you can't even make an argument that they didn't get better. Yeah. Because I think you could. Well, so I think that's a huge part of it. Do I think they're the best team in the division? I don't know. I still think it's probably the Cardinals. Maybe it's that Cardinal Devil magic. I have got to look at it. And I know I haven't looked at it recently because it's been a couple weeks since I've thought about baseball, like as in what's going to happen on the field.
No, that's fair.
And so, I can't. I think it's kind of a gut. And maybe it's just that, like, that's kind of why I'm like with the Brewers. It's like, I don't understand what they're doing, but I never understand what they're doing. And they're so much smarter than I am. I mean, it's like the opposite of the Rockies, you know,
yeah, that's a good point. Like,
I never know what they're doing, but the Rockies, I know it's going to be messed up. And I don't know that they're smarter than me, even though I'm not a brain surgeon.
Right. And the Brewers are very polite and nice and actually respectful of other professionals. It's remarkable.
Well, and that's because their GM is a failed sports writer, so he knows how hard it is.
And
I wrote that story. Did you read that?
I did. Yeah, that was a great story. And then
it was fun. He wasn't a really good sports writer, but he was good. You know, but none of us were as freshmen in college. Well, I wasn't. You may have been.
I was a cartoonist my freshman year in college.
So yeah, there you go.
So I wrote a little bit,
but yeah. So like, you know, like I never know what the Brewers are doing. But it works, you know.
They're very good, and they have a great manager.
It's a fantastic manager, one of the best, I think. And so And so that's one of those things where I give them the benefit of the doubt, just like I give the Cardinals the benefit of the doubt for their devil magic.
Do you give the Cubs the benefit of the doubt because of their talent?
I give them, because I think ultimately they still have a lot of talent. Though I will say I had like a Cubs scout, and this was at the winter meeting. So this is pre-Castellanos, pre-Miley, pre-Strope, and even pre-Shogo, Akiyama, who just said to me, the Reds are better than us right now.
Well, I have a good story for that. Would you like to hear this as a Red Sure. beat writer? All right. So the Cubs had this discussion, and this was during the season. The Cubs thought that the Reds were the team to beat this season. And they based that on the fact that there was a general sense that because of the pitching and because, you know, they'd get healthy or whatever, that if last year's season had gone two more weeks, the Reds would have won the division because they just had things not going right, but that they were the better team.
And Jeff Hoyer said that to me.
Yeah, yeah. The Cubs were some Reds. I mean, I don't want to call them fans, but they were advocates of this notion that the Reds were playing the best baseball. The Cardinals were playing the hottest baseball, but had the season gone on just a little bit longer and health had been restored and there'd been a regression to the mean or whatever, the Reds would have been the better team.
It's funny. That matches up with what Jed Hoyer told me in the Cactus League Media Day. And I didn't know if he was just doing that, but the fact that you heard that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, this was during the season. You know, this was as they kind of mapped out and then coming out of the season. So, yeah, it's interesting. All right, so opening day that wouldn't be. I know what I do on opening day at Cincinnati. I enjoy going opening day at Cincinnati. I enjoy opening day just in general. I love it. My opening day tradition, I think. Yeah, probably.
I just don't remember it. But like when you say it, I'll recognize.
Well, I'll bring packs of baseball cards to everybody at their desks and everything like that. I do that on the road and then here at home. I don't remember
you doing that 8 years ago.
Oh, yeah, I did it.
Huh? Maybe you just didn't give one to me.
It's entirely possible because I'll be honest. There were years where I would run out and I did not buy enough, especially on the road. That is very possible.
So you probably just did it for, you know, your traveling guy, your Cardinal guys, have. Which makes sense.
I might have.
Yeah.
If I couldn't find them, then
we used to be friends, but that's fine.
Well, I'll mail them to you. I got time.
I get postcards, so I can't say anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I send you lots of postcards.
I have one like on my desk, right? I mean, this is another tangent, but in front of my desk, I have a bullet, like a push pen board, you know, push board, cork board.
Yep.
And Space of Honor, right corner, left corner. So it's right there in my field of vision is that gorgeous Roberto Clemente postcard you sent me.
Yeah. You have the, you may have one of the few, if not one of one postcard where I did a drawing on it.
Ooh.
I think you have one of
on the
two.
Back?
On the back.
Not on this one.
No. I sent it to your daughter.
Oh, yes, you did. I have that as well.
With a pork, I believe I drew. So it's one of the few that I actually drew on. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I have time to write postcards now.
You know, I really do need to send you one. So I love that. I love that. What's it called? That tradition you have. And maybe I'll start doing that. I need to find a place to get postcards right now, but I think I have some.
Yeah, I have shoeboxes full here.
I bet you do.
What would you be doing? So, opening day. What would you be doing opening day? What are some of the things that you would have been tackling?
You know, I always try to make it a little different. So this year, I did have a speaking engagement in the morning, like a 10 o'clock, or I think it's 9:30, at like the Cincinnati Rotary. And they're going to give money to a charity for me.
That's nice.
So yeah, like they do an honorarium, or is that how you say it? How do you say it? I've never gotten honorarium. One, so I don't. Honorarium. Thank you. They usually do an honorarium, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll probably do it to some dog rescue, which I think was really neat. Apparently, they do this every opening day, and apparently, one year a former ball player spoke and. His honorarium was his own bank account.
Yeah.
Which I would feel really weird doing that, but that's me.
Yeah.
So
not a gilded castle. It's okay.
Yes. So where was I?
You were saying what you would do.
So I would have done that. And then I would have just gotten the ballpark early last year. I got to the ballpark even earlier because it was the last year of Marty Brenneman.
Right.
And so I said, "Hey, Marty, when do you get here? Can I follow you for a day?" And it was Marty's last opening day. So I pretty much spent most of the game with Marty, and I started actually when he pulled into the garage. I got into his car and to his parking space, followed him through. There's a great Goodfellas photo. I think I put it in the story where the way he kind of goes through to where he sits was through the press dining room kitchen. And so I kind of follow of him going through the kitchen, and that is my Goodfellas shot.
That's good.
And so, yeah, it was really cool. So I don't know. It always depends on what I'm doing. And when I was with the Enquirer, we usually had a 2-man team. So either I would try to do something, either a sidebar off the game or just something completely different like that. Last year, I kind of knew that I just didn't care about the game last year. I cared. To me, there was a bigger story, and that was Marty. And I knew everybody was going to do his last day of the season. I wanted to do his last opening day because his opening day in Cincinnati. And and so I did that. And I also knew nobody else was going to do it. Somebody else was going
to
do.
Not many people have the option to do that too. I mean, that's one of the real strengths of what you've done with your beat and what the Athletic has allowed people to do with their beat is to, while everybody is walking this path because that's the requirement of their job, find another path to walk. They don't need game coverage and ceremony coverage and pomp and circumstance coverage like a paper of record has to have.
Right. And there's so much value into a paper of record. And I try to, even when I'm doing something different, I'm like, oh, it's great you're doing something different. I'm doing something different because, Bobby Nightingale at the Enquirer and Mark Sheldon at MLB.com, they're doing the paper record stuff. I mean, that has value. And I'm trying to do something just different because I know there are other people doing that and doing that really well. And on my beat, it's Bobby and Mark. So even though they're at a different place than I am, a different organization, they're working for different people. The fact that they do their job well helps me do my job well.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's a holistic approach to coverage.
Yeah.
You give everybody, a little bit of what they want. And I think there's room for that. And obviously, you're competitive and obviously you want to get the good story. And sometimes you can get a little jealous of the person who gets to chase, the story on the backstage story while you have to review the play. But
right,
that's how it goes. All right, so you
so yeah up, so
what were you and, looking forward to about this opening day? I mean, besides speaking in the morning.
I just kind of the excitement, and I hadn't on purpose I hadn't thought about what I was going to write. Last year I knew from the moment that I heard Marty Brenneman was going to retire. And at that moment was kind of odd for me because I got a late alert when I stepped off a boat or a ship in Cienfuegos, Cuba. It was pretty cool. So that's where I found out. And I was like, oh, hope somebody at home's taking care of this one. Ew. And I was like, you know what? Opening day is going to be huge. Knowing that it is opening day and what we talked about, opening day Cincinnati and Marty, who is just synonymous with Cincinnati. So that idea came into my head automatically. And there are always these stories that are in my head that I know, oh, this date I'm doing this. And a lot of times they don't come to fruition. Sometimes because Derek Gould doesn't come to Cincinnati. And I had a great story bookmarked one day that was on you.
Yeah.
And I'll still probably try to do it some other time.
We should do it sometime. It was a good idea.
And it's a story I really want to do sometime. No. And basically, one of the big reasons I thought of it was because of you. So I just didn't feel like I could do it without you.
Well, thanks. Thanks for saying that.
And also, not only did you not come to Cincinnati, I probably skipped a St. Louis trip too. It can be on both of us. But like,
been there together for opening day.
Yeah, I wasn't going to do it opening day.
No, you can't. No,
that story. That was a August story.
Yeah.
But like, so I didn't have anything in my mind of what I was going to do. I mean, I was going to play off the general excitement, and I didn't know what form that would take. I just don't. But that would be my overall thought. I didn't know if it was something about seeing if there was a pocket of Japanese fans, because again, this is my own little interest. The Reds were the last team in Major League Baseball to sign, well, or will be the last, because it hasn't happened yet, to have a Japanese born player play for them.
Really?
They were 30 of 30. So, and they signed Shogo Akiyama. It had been them and the Marlins for several years, and they got Ichiro. And so, a little background, I went to high school in Japan. So, I've always had a fondness for Japanese baseball. It's something I've followed, something I've been very interested in. So yeah. That I had been pushing for as long as I remember doing a story in 2007, my first year on the beat, because, the Rays signed Akinora. Was it Iwakuma? And so like I did a thing about Japanese players. Akinora Iwamura. So basically, and I just had Wayne Krivsky, the GM at the time, saying, no, too expensive, just not something we're going to play in. And there were different, reasons for all that. Well, a couple years ago, the Reds, when Dick Williams officially took over for Walt Jocketty, he launched a, the Pacific Rim scouting department, and had boots on the ground in Asia. And that was something that was kind of looking forward to. And so in some point, I think it was early, maybe late November, early December, because I've been on this, they talked to Aoki. Aoki was a guy that they had some interest in a couple years ago, when he signed with, I think the, did he sign with the Giants then? It was after 2015 when he was with the Royals and he became a free agent. But they had some interest in him then, and talked a little bit about that. So again, because it's nobody was as interested in this as I was, but one of my fundamental, is it guidelines? Is that too much? Is that too much? One of my things is,
guardrails.
But for me, man doesn't have to have a credo, but if you're going to have a credo or something like that, if I'm not interested in what I'm writing, why will anybody else be? So sometimes I'm a little selfish with what I write, because I'm like, man, maybe I'm the only person interested in this. But at least if I'm interested, there's a better chance I can make it interesting than if I'm not interested.
I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that is genuinely a good way to go about this. And I know that I have had times where I get assignments. We all get assignments. There are news that happens that you're like, okay, I need to cover this. There are stories that mostly stories of tragedy that I don't want to write. But then I think, all right, well, I owe a responsibility to that person or that person's family to write this respectfully and to write this well, so that this, so that, you know, it's true to that person, or it's true to the situation, or it's true to the tragedy. But as far as like stories that aren't like that, I think that's a really good way to go about it. And look, man, you know, we have to write notebooks. We have to do things that like sometimes are like, okay, I just got to slog through things. But I still take your approach where, how can I write this so that I actually am entertained by it? Because you're right. If I'm just going through the motions, then how can I argue that a reader won't just go through the motions? And this is a time where we can't afford that. Readers don't go through the motions. Readers can go find their information where they're entertained. Readers can go find their information where they're given the voice that they want, or the opinion that they want, or the decibel level that they want. So you better enjoy what you're covering, and you better share that with the reader so it becomes an experience, you know, a shared experience. And if you don't approach stories where you also try to entertain yourself, then you're right. You'll find that the readers aren't very entertained, and then you won't have any stories to write at all, or you'll just be literally writing for yourself. So would Shogo have been in the starting lineup on opening day then? Would the Reds have brought an end? Okay.
It's a great question. I don't.
I asked them professionally.
Because, you know, when you look at it, they've got several different options.
Yeah.
I think it would depend on where Nick Senzel was. If Nick Senzel's healthy, there's a question. If he's not healthy, there's no question. Because Nick Senzel is coming back from shoulder surgery. They were hopeful that he would be ready to start the season, but who knows? Same with Eugenio Suarez.
Right, right.
So,
well, that's the thing about this pause, this delay, this stoppage, that we, this indefinite, you know, basically, I don't know how to put it, indefinite hiatus that baseball is on, is it is allowing some of these players to get healthy. It is allowing Miles Michaelis, whenever opening day is likely going to be available to the Cardinals. You know, you have other players who, you know, Paul Goldschmidt with his elbow, he'll have this much more time to get healthy. And same with like what you're describing with the Reds. What would have been the rotation for this opening series for the Reds?
Probably, I think it would have been Castillo, Gray. I'm looking at his three game series. Castillo, Gray, Bauer.
So, and Castillo had already been announced as the opening day. It was
he had
number two, and he had not.
But he was, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
He had not been announced, but it was him.
Yeah, he was on turn. Why had they not announced it?
They were just waiting.
Drama.
Yeah, I don't even know it's drama. It's just, you know, they went a couple years, and this is before both of, you know, anybody who's currently here. But like Anthony DeSclafani, I think, has been announced the opening day starter at least twice and has never been an opening day starter.
Why is that?
Injury.
Okay, I see. I understand. Okay.
I mean, they came into camp understanding, knowing that it was going to be Jose Peraza. Or not, I'm sorry, not Jose Peraza. He's no longer here. Luis Castillo, but it just was never announced. It was kind of, it's kind of, honestly, it doesn't matter who the manager has been, but it's almost like an ongoing joke with the Reds and Rob Butcher and
the media relations coordinator
and the media relations. Yeah. And the writers about it being, these kind of things. It's the opening day starter and who's the opening day starter going to be. And so I think I asked on our first day.
It become a running joke between manager Mike Schilt with the Cardinals and Hall of Fame writer Rick Hummel, who would always want to know the pitching rotation and, you know, who was coming up during spring training and who was next on deck. And there's a functional reason for that. One is because newspapers do like to print those things days ahead of time, or at least the day before. So there's a reason for asking. But also just became, like you said, like an ongoing kind of riff between the two. And at one point in time, Schilt was getting ready to announce
Rift the as in joke, quarter. Not as in Rift, as in
right, Rift. Riff, yeah, riff. Riff, not as riff. Not as in a rift. Yes, good clarification there. Thank you. A riff,
because I could see it becoming one of those under other.
Oh, it did. Oh, yeah. No, it's a good important thing, because I would have used the different word 4 or 5 years ago to describe, because it had become a rift.
Or you would have just added the T. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the more confusing small riffs that developed over time. But the, so it got to a point where Schilt was going to get ready to announce the inevitable opening day starter for the Reds, or for the Cardinals, the obvious opening day starter. Everybody knew it, long about last July, who the opening day starter was going to be for the Cardinals. But he wouldn't do it. Schilt wouldn't do it until Hummel joined the group. So a nice little nod to the Hall of Famer. Would have been Jack Flaherty. The intrigue was probably who would have been game three starter. Imagine that it would have set up that it would have been Flaherty and then Wainwright number two. That would have allowed Wainwright to make the opening day start at home and been on turn for the Busch Stadium start in what could be his final season. So that would have been somewhat of a nice ceremonial nod. And then you had number three could have been Dakota Hudson, right? Coming off a strong season and all that stuff. They could have gone with Carlos Martinez as a real kind of, nod to the spring that he had and the job that he won and his past as the leader of the rotation as an all-star. So the intrigue would have been with game three. It would not have shocked me at all if the Cardinals went into that series with the pitching edge and came out of it feeling pretty good about themselves. And that over time, as the season played on, May becomes June becomes July, that the Reds would be the better team, that opening day weekend would not have been the tell as to what direction these teams were going, rather affirmation of the strength of the Cardinals pitching, and then a hint of how the Reds were going to be the team that got better and better and better as the season went along, which is really what you want to be.
Yeah. No, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you'd have Wainwright Gray on game two.
That'd be good.
Yeah. I mean, Flaherty Castillo, that's.
Would have been good.
Yeah.
Carlos versus Trevor Bauer.
Carlos Martinez. Fun. I mean, that is.
Been a lot of fun.
That's awesome. I mean, that's a great first weekend of baseball.
It is.
You can get excited. I mean, at this point, we were excited. I watched an inner squad game of Dan Straley versus Adrian Sampson in Korea the other night. I can get excited about that.
You're amazing.
But think about that. That's such a man. I love that a lot.
Yeah. It would have been fun. Would have been fun.
You want to know maybe the worst part. And I had a friend who already said, I'm blocking anybody who mentions this. And, on the Twitters. But tomorrow is a high of 61, low of 50, 10% chance of rain.
Wow.
In Cincinnati. I mean, if it's even right now it's a little chilly, so it's not quite what it is, but it's just a beautiful day. So far.
The sun would have been out on opening day. Welcome
to
a new
season. A little chill in the air, but not overly cold. Basically just perfect opening day weather.
Wow.
But rain on Saturday and Sunday, so.
Yeah. Man, it would have been eerie to play in front of an empty crowd, but that might be where this is headed too. So.
I would be surprised if we don't start that way.
Yeah.
And that was another one, you're talking about, what were you going to write? If it were there, I would see if I could go and sit in the best seat in the house and what that's like.
Oh, yeah. And watch the game from there. That'd be interesting. Yeah. Or, you get to hear, I was talking with a player and he said, if they play in front of empty crowds, you'll be able to hear what the players are saying anyways. Why not put them on mics for everybody back home?
I don't even know that you're going to have to mic them up.
Right. Yeah. He said, you just hear everybody anyways. Why not make it part of the show? I thought that was a great point.
Yeah,
I don't want to let you go though, because now that
I don't want to let you go either, Derek.
Oh, thanks. We've circled back to the absence and just how it's both an odd feeling, but it's also a necessary feeling to not have baseball at this time. We know why. We get it. Health is more important. There's a national crisis out there, and baseball for the first time really in history would not have provided a distraction to the national crisis, and instead would have fed it by bringing people together in large crowds and create an accelerant for the virus at hand. So we understand that. And since we've brought it back to the hollow ballpark that exists in both of our downtowns, let's try to at least fill the end of the podcast with baseball stories. And I want to ask you about a specific one so that we can tell a baseball legend, and then I'll open up the floor for you just to tell your favorite baseball story, which probably will involve George Brett, but maybe not. I want to ask you about Devin Mesoraco, and I'm getting in the Wayback Machine, but it's one of the stories you've done of many that have stuck with me, from a baseball tale perspective, but also from a baseball writer perspective. I have such admiration for baseball writers who find good stories and how they do it. But Devin Mesoraco made his own bats, essentially. He grew the trees, and from these trees, he had bats made. That's like Roy Hobbs carving his own bat. Bunyan.
My lead was too obvious.
What was it? And can you kind of tell me how you found that story?
So many of stories, and I think you'll agree with this, and here I'm going to start this with a story about basketball. And I told this story to somebody recently, a young writer I was talking to. They did a great story, and they're like, I didn't do anything. It just came to me. And I remember early in my career, my first beat aside from preps, I started on high school sports. And then my first one was University of Georgia basketball at the Athens Banner Herald. And one of their players, D.A. Lane, was going to leave early and go to declare for the NBA draft. Turns out he didn't get drafted, blah, blah, blah. One of those kind of things was a mistake, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so D.A. calls me and tells me, and I write it and I get the scoop. And this is back in the day when you would write it and hold it for the paper, and it didn't go out on the internet. I didn't tweet it or anything. This is 1990 or 2001, 2000, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the story and I scooped. And the guy I scooped, who was my competition on the beat, was the guy at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who did football and basketball, Mark Schlabel. Now, Mark Schlabel is at ESPN now. He's a phenomenal reporter.
Right.
Here I am, and I scooped Schlabel. And, I'm getting some pats on the backs, ESPN ticker, T.A. Lane going, according to the Athens Banner-Herald. And one of my friends, Josh Kendall, who now covers South Carolina for The Athletic, he's the football writer at the time. And he's like, hey, really good job, man. Hey, congratulations. I was like, Josh, I didn't do anything. He just called and I wrote it. I didn't do any work. And he said, Trent, you did the work. That came to you because you did the work. So often in reporting, it's not like that I reported this story that I sniffed it out and I got all this. It kind of came to me because I had done the work. Mm-hmm. And reporting is all about doing the work and putting in the time and being there when you don't have to be, and building those relationships before you have to. I remember talking to Joey Votto in spring training of 2007 when he was waiting for his ride because he was a minor leaguer, didn't have his own car. Mm-hmm. That's putting in the work, and you don't necessarily aren't doing it just to put in the work, but you do put it in the work. I've known Joey Votto since 2006.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I've always followed the minor leagues.
Report.
Right. Yeah. And so like people say, oh, you do great stuff with Joey Votto. And I'm like, yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm just a stenographer. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, that's, you get those answers because you've put in the work. And that was with the DA Lane story. Josh Kendall told me, he's like, no, you put in the work. That came to you. That's reporting.
Right.
And so that's kind of what happened with the Devin Mesoraco thing. I've known Devin since he was in the minor leagues. I cover the minor leagues a bit, and I think you do the same thing. And I try to get into those guys and talk to those guys. I try to go down to a couple different series a year. I spent last year in spring training, I watched more minor league games than major league games in spring training.
Hmm. That was more valuable to the Reds at that time.
Yeah, and also because, again, I'm not paper or record. I didn't have to be there. I wasn't there when Scooter Gennett got injured, but I drove to Maryvale as soon as he did. And I was there when David Bell talked about it. So
do you see Devin Mesoraco's branding on his bat and know, or is it something that Devin brings up to you? Or?
Devin just kind of, if I remember correctly, and I'm really doing, he gets in and I can just see him. I think I saw him showing it off to somebody. I said, oh, mm-hmm. new bats or whatever. He goes, yeah, look at this. And he shows me the thing and he tells me the story. And I said, Devin, that has such a great story. Can we sit and talk about this for a story? He's like, oh yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Basically he had always had an interest. He has, he's from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Same place as Groundhog Day.
Exactly. And so, but that is also an area rich with, whatever kind of, I don't remember if it was ash or maple. But it's a place where a lot of baseball bats look for their baseball bats or for their trees. And so he is with Mariucci and he just tells his rep, he's like, hey, you know what I always think would be really cool? I know I have these kind of trees on my property.
Maple.
Maple. You know, I have maple. I would love to see if I can get bats made out of them, even if it's not a, you know, game bat. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was Jack Mariucci who came out, or one of his guys, his logger, his thing. He goes, Devin, this is great tree. This is exactly the kind of trees we look for. And so they took down a couple of trees on his property. Mm-hmm. And he finds them and he makes them into bats, and he got as many bats as he could. And then like the ones that are just not quite big league level wood, he made for his brothers. And so, yeah, he was really interested in the process. And
that's awesome.
I'm always interested in gear process. I don't know why. Maybe it's just a kid. I always wanted a new glove or a new bat or whatever. So
I'm fascinated by gloves.
Oh,
yeah,
me too.
Yeah.
I have a story idea I've always wanted to do, and I need to do it. I need to talk to somebody about it. But gloves are just fascinate the hell out of me.
Yeah,
And I wasn't a good hitter, so bats a little less so.
Did Devin use the bat in a game? He did.
Yeah.
How many bats did he get? Do you recall?
I think it might have been like 20, but that was when he got hurt. That was the year he got hurt. And so, I mean, he may not have even used them all up.
Wow. That's just so a remarkable story. I mean, you just think of it like growing a bat in your backyard, in your yard, how many players could do that? What was your lead?
Shit, I don't remember.
You want me to read it to you?
Yeah.
You want me to do a dramatic reading?
Oh, no, because I think it sucked. I think the lead's terrible.
True. No,
it's so hacky and terrible. It was the obvious lead, and I don't like it very much. But
you know what? Sometimes the obvious lead is the necessary lead. So, all right, here we go. Ready for a dramatic reading of this? Let's see if I can actually do this. Reds' Devin Mesoraco boasts homegrown bats by C. Trent Rosecrans, Cincinnati Inquirer. Devin Mesoraco's bat is a model DM814. And the pop-up ad just came up. All right, let's try this again. Devin Mesoraco's bat is a model DM814, but it might as well say Wonder Boy. This past offseason, Mesoraco had a dozen bats, especially made for him by Marucci Sports, from trees from his home in Pennsylvania. None of the trees were felled by lightning like they were in the natural, but they're still as close as you'll get in the big leagues to Roy Hobbs' mythical bat. I mean, I got to imagine, like, there isn't a ball player with a glove made from, you know, leather from his ranch, or, you know, cleats mined from a nearby, I don't even know where that would come from, or like cleats from a nearby smelt, I guess. I mean, but so this is just remarkable. I mean, just, it's, I thought it was a great story. So congratulations.
Well, thank
it was
you.
Years ago,
that.
but it still has stuck with me for, like, you know, just
and
as far as the legend.
In good sense. So I appreciate
That's
it.
Not true. You did an excellent story. You were part of the athletics work on the Codebreaker. Could you?
Oh, I did very little on that.
Yeah, but that story came out at an interesting time because Mike Schilt and I were talking about how when we were kids watching, you know, the playoff games and World Series games, and we would be at home, and I remember this so vividly, like it's how I learned signs and everything like that. And we'd be at home, and we would know a pitch is coming because we would have picked up the signals from the opposing team because we had the view that the opposing team, or, you know, from the battery, we had the view that the opposing team did not when there were no runners on base. And so it didn't take long because we had that television angle that you could see the pitcher's signs. You know, you at home could know something. You were in on the secret that the batter didn't know. And how that just was part of the magic of baseball. And, you know, now, of course, we know that, you know, teams use that and everything like that. So you were part of the Codebreaker work. I mean, you've done a lot of great work, and that's why I want to give you the floor. Tell me a baseball fable.
I was telling my wife about this the other night when I turned in the story about Rod Serling and this 1955 teleplay that he did called O'Toole from Moscow. It was a comedy that was shown once on NBC. They used to have, you know, they did live TV shows back in the day. And this was shown once on December 12th, 1955. And it was about a Russian guy who worked at the Russian consulate who fell in love with baseball, and then his bodyguard becomes screws up. They like leave and they can only get to Cincinnati, and Cincinnati tries to tries to call the Russian consulate, but he can't find a Russian consulate in the phone book. The only thing he can find is Reds, and his bodyguard turns out to be like a baseball savant, can hit the ball a million. He's hitting it higher or further than Ted Klazuski, and he becomes a hero, and blah blah blah, hilarity ensues.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's kind of a cool thing. It was written by Rod Serling before he did the Twilight Zone.
Okay.
So yeah. So anyway, this is kind of a reporting story too, because I wrote this story, and anyway, I wrote the story last night because one of the local public radio station, WVXU, did a radio drama of it, and it premiered Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. I think it's available at wvxu.org as well. So they did like a radio play of this. And so anyway, like I was talking to my wife about it after I finished writing it, and I was like, oh yeah, I think that story turned out okay. I had a lot of stuff I didn't get in there, but that's always a good sign. When you leave off, I was told by my journalism professor, like, when you leave off something like precious to you, that means you did a pretty good job reporting. If you get everything in that you wanted to get in, you didn't do it a good enough job reporting.
Right. Yeah. You ran out. You want some meat left over on the plate. Yep.
And so, yeah. So that was kind of what I did. But I think you'll appreciate this. John Kieswetter is the guy who wrote the story or wrote the teleplay and found it. In 1988. He wrote a story, or 89 maybe. Anyway, he wrote a story about Rod Serling starting his television career in Cincinnati at WKRC. And he learned a little bit about the O'Toole from Moscow. And he said over the years, he was at the Enquirer until 2014. So over the years from there, he wrote said maybe 8 to 12 stories about Serling and his Cincinnati ties, but he never wrote about O'Toole from Cincinnati because his dream was to recreate it and have it done somewhere. And then when he was laid off, he was from the Enquirer, or took a buyout, I don't remember which. He went to WVXU, the local radio station, and he does still a lot of stuff for WVXU. And, you know, he wanted to find the script, and he didn't find the script till 2016. So this is 27 years later. He finds the script, and he just happens to be working at a radio station. And so he gets in touch with Serling's daughter, who didn't know this existed. And she had written a book about her and her dad, and, you know, kind of cataloged a lot of the different things he had written and didn't know about this.
Yeah.
This particular one. But he was Rod Serling was a huge baseball fan. So he, so John Keysweater puts together this and gets it. And so they were able to make a radio play out of it.
That's awesome.
A radio drama. And it's very 1955-y, Red Scare. It's a comedy, which was rare for Serling.
Sure.
But it's really neat. And so, like, I talked to Ann Serling, and I talked to John, and just did a quickie kind of story on it, but I thought it was interesting. And I was
that
like,
is
oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
That's a great little story.
And I left some stuff out. And so I was like, when I left stuff out, I feel better about a story.
What's the name of the ball player in it? Of the guy who becomes a ball player?
Well, his name is Joseph. Oh shoot, I don't remember his Russian last name off the top of my head. But they call him O'Toole for some reason. I don't know. I haven't read the script or heard it yet.
Five tool player, maybe.
Yeah, but guess who plays him?
Who?
Oh well, you wouldn't guess. It would be hard to guess. But Chuck Connors played him originally.
Oh wow!
Before he was the Rifleman, but after he was a Chicago Cub.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. So one of his entry points into acting was as a ball player. Makes sense. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And so, wow. I mean, like, that was a perfect casting.
Reagan-esque.
Yeah.
So the question I have, though, is does O'Toole make his own bats?
I don't know. Does he have the O'Tools to do it?
All right, we're over.
Yeah, that's enough to cancel everything.
Yeah, that's the people who listen to this are gonna go, we waited that long for that.
Yeah, so, it's like one of those bad jokes that the punchline is that, like, you can keep them on forever and then the punchline's terrible.
Wow. Yeah. All right, we'll close with this. So your picks to win the World Series, whenever it is, on Christmas Day, apparently.
The Yankees?
Sure. Because everybody gets to be healthy.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Not the Mets.
All things being equal, Trent, I would appreciate you taking this time to record this at a safe distance, a socially acceptable distance, as we're supposed to say. I would rather have recorded this like we normally do in the stands somewhere. And I'm bummed that we're not having a scheduled Skyline Chili lunch at some point in time.
Because we were going to get together today.
Yeah.
We're recording Wednesday. It's really Thursday. We were going to be together Thursday too, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. We were going to have dinner and we had plans, and I dig the Skyline Chili. I like the nooks and crannies of Cincinnati that
I've got some good stuff in, like, our neighborhood, and I've come into your neighborhood as well, and I was gonna return that favor.
I'd like
still
that
on the table. We will still do that.
We will still do that. And and I have to ask for a mulligan on my pinball misadventure. I will tell you this though, like, you know, I did go to what is it, is it 16-bit, is that the name of it, or 8-bit?
Yeah, 16-bit.
16-bit. I went to 16-bit, and I may have got the high score on the Star Wars arcade game there. Just to let you know.
Nice. Yeah.
Oh, I'm pretty proud of that.
Our friend Josh Sneed has a Reds pinball machine in his custom-made Reds pinball machine in his basement. We should probably go over. I think he has two pinball machines. We should go, Josh. I think one of those opening days you recorded with us, Josh was our co-host. He's a comedian, not local. I mean, he's local. He's a comedian, but
he's great.
He's great. He has a t-shirt company that has actually great just got the Major League Baseball license.
Awesome.
So
that's exciting.
I know it's cincyshirts.com, and I don't remember what the new offshoot that's not just Cincinnati stuff. So there will be some good Cardinals shirts.
Yeah.
And MLS, and he got I think he got MLB Players Association license. Maybe that's what it
was. That's exciting.
MLS and MLS Players Association, which will be relevant to the St. Louis market here soon.
Yep. Looking forward to it. And then we'll have Cincinnati, St. Louis rivalry in soccer, St. Louis, Cincinnati rivalry in baseball when baseball resumes. And we already have St. Louis, Cincinnati rivalry in baseball writers. It just manifests over a pinball machine. That's all.
Yes.
And
bad pizza.
And bad pizza. But mostly pinball. We each have bad pizza. I get it. Yeah. There's a really good pizza place that has a pinball machine in my neighborhood.
Nice.
Yeah.
I've been to the Japanese restaurant in your neighborhood, and we just have a new Japanese restaurant in our neighborhood that you'll have to come.
It's a good place. I'm looking forward to it. All right. Well, we'll catch up, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Dude, I wanted to do this anyway. This was for me, and it's always kind of good. It's actually, I'll share this. Our CEO I don't think he would be upset if I shared this, but yesterday he kind of came on our Slack. Everybody has Slack these days.
I don't have Slack.
Oh, you guys don't use Slack? Anyway, basically he asked us to do four things every day during this. And they ordered us all to go home a while ago. It says, number one, FaceTime with a loved one for someone that may be lonely. Two, work out for at least 15 minutes. Three, go for a walk outside. Four, support a local restaurant store or a store. And those were the four directions that we were supposed to do every day, everybody in the company.
And, that's great.
I think that's a pretty awesome place to start. And so that's from Alex Mather. That is the athletic challenge.
That's good.
Athletic COVID challenge is to do this every day. Each day we will hold each other accountable in accomplishing the following.
And that's really encouraging.
I just think that's a cool thing. And that's one of the reasons I like working for this company. Is what our focus is. And we were told to go home before everybody else was. And just said, take care of your family.
You don't have to be an employee at the Athletic to follow those rules.
But those are good things. I think everybody should do.
Those are good things for, if you want to be a part of a community. And our community is, not only like we've learned, this podcast, the best podcast in baseball, has created a community. Baseball writers are a community. Baseball fans writ large are a community. Baseball itself is the connective tissue of a community. So we can keep all that in mind. And it doesn't hurt to tell baseball stories because we won't have baseball games. But that doesn't mean we have to go without baseball.
And subscribe to your local newspapers.
Yes, thank you for saying that.
The Cincinnati Enquirer. I made sure. I just actually paid my bill while we were talking because I wanted to make sure it was up to date. Because local journalism, we are seeing why local journalism matters.
Absolutely.
If you're in Cincinnati, subscribe to the Cincinnati Enquirer. I don't work there anymore, so I'm not even saying mine. If you're in St. Louis, subscribe to St. Louis Post-Dispatch. If you're in Columbia, Missouri, the Tribune?
Columbia Daily Tribune.
If you're in Jefferson City, if you're in, I don't know if the California Democrat's even there. My dad used to get the California Democrat. My dad's from California, Missouri. Wherever we lived, we always got the California Democrat, the weekly, mailed to us. So we were in Japan and got the California Democrat.
Wow. That's awesome.
That's how, and we lived, we were in Cuba and we got the California Democrat. I don't know. I guess it comes by me naturally that I have these kind of things. So subscribe wherever you are. If you're in Mattoon, Illinois, your local paper, that's my spiel, and I think it's so important.
Well, thank you very much, Trent. Thanks for joining me here. Thanks for talking baseball. I'm sure I will hit you up again sometime. And we can have just a podcast of maybe Joey Votto stories. That seems to be.
There are a couple of those.
Thank you very much, Trent. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
A special thanks to C. Trent Rosecrans of The Athletic in Cincinnati, the Cincinnati Reds beat writer for The Athletic, for joining me here on the Best Podcast in Baseball. The Best Podcast in Baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. Get organized with Closets by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's Closets by Design of St. Louis, the official sponsor of the Best Podcast in Baseball. You can find the Best Podcast in Baseball and all of the other podcasts produced by STLToday.com and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch at STLToday.com. That's where you'll also find all of the latest coronavirus coverage from our news side and all of the continuing sports coverage from our sports writers who, there aren't any games, but there's a lot of news. There's a lot of profiles. There's a lot of stories yet to tell, and we will be doing our best to bring them to you consistently. We'll also have coverage of the opening day that wasn't at STLToday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. The Best Podcast in Baseball is also available wherever you get your podcasts. It's available on iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes, or subscribe to the podcast. Subscriptions make the sponsorships possible, and sponsorships, especially these days, make the podcast possible. So we'll continue to bring BPIB to you weekly throughout this stoppage in baseball, throughout what's become a national crisis, because we have sponsorships, and we have sponsorships because of the community that has developed around BPIB. You can also rate and review BPIB. As you may have heard in this podcast, I do pay attention to those. Somebody wanted me to stop the rants about the Rockies GM, so I'm going to do my best to do so. Promise. I mean, I'm no brain surgeon, but I'll figure it out. So please rate and review. I do pay attention. We'll try to be responsive to the community that BPIB has created. Very appreciative to it. Very appreciative to you listening all the way to this point, as Trent and I just chatted baseball for a while and I turned on the record. Best Podcast in Baseball. We'll be back next week. Looking forward to trying to draw Ben Fredrickson back into this from, yes, a socially acceptable distance. We'll just tell baseball stories. That just seems like the way to go. We'll use the podcast to tell baseball stories. Until next week, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. This has been the Best Podcast in Baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design. Talk to you soon. Stay healthy. Please stay healthy out there.
Now I have to ask you, how do you literally talk to Alexa to do everything?
I do a lot on Alexa. Yeah, well, we do. I have a good morning code. It turns on certain lights in the house. It tells me the weather.
We need a closing for this podcast, so I think there's not anything better than how you close out your office.
Oh, so I have my office. It's like I say, she who shall not be named. You say that and you say office and it turns on the lights in my office. Well, this, my office was originally my daughter's playroom. So I've kept what we use to turn it off. And that is she who shall not be named, mischief managed. And it all turns off all the lights in my office. So Derek, Best Podcast in Baseball, mischief managed.